Shiva.
Vandana Shiva.
Vandana Shiva. V-A-N-D-A-N-A. Her approach is going to be somewhat different from what we've been doing, partly because she's a woman, but...
You're going to pass her around?
Yeah, passing her around. I'll give you her bio, and then we'll get into what she says. She was born in India in 1952. She received degrees in physics from universities in India, and then went to Canada for a PhD in philosophy. So she's both a philosopher and a scientist. In 1982, she founded the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology, which I believe is still in existence. And out of that came a group called Navdanya, which is an activist organization advocating for organic farming, biodiversity, the saving of seeds, and the rights of farmers. So her primary concern is saving indigenous agriculture, saving sustenance agriculture as it has been practiced sustainably for generations against the onslaught of industrial agriculture. She has campaigned against globalization and the corporate takeover of resources. She's against the genetic modification of foods and the patenting of genetic material, which she calls biopiracy. And in place of all of this, she has a philosophy that she calls Earth Democracy, which values the contributions and the experiences of all people, all communities, and all other species.
What was it that you're making? What was the
Earth
term again?
Earth Democracy. She consults to numerous organizations. She speaks at many gatherings. She travels all over the world to different events and conferences. And she's written over 20 books. Some of the better known of these include Stolen Harvest, came out in 2000, a book that was called Earth Democracy, 2005, Soil Not Oil, that's my favorite title. Soil, Not Oil, came out in 2008. Monocultures of the Mind, 2011. And Making Peace with the Earth, 2012.
What was the name of her research foundation for?
Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Ecology. She is really considered one of the leaders of the global anti-globalization movement. I've just heard in the last week, I've heard from two different people who have gone to India to work with her, to spend a week learning from her and working with her. So she's definitely in the forefront of developing not only a critique, but a new way of thinking about how we should be organizing the world, or unorganizing it, more to the point. She says that the industrial economy is a war against the earth. And here's a direct quote. The global corporate economy, based on the idea of limitless growth, has become a permanent war economy against the planet and people. And she says that globalization is an extension of colonialism and imperialism. So, and coming from India, she knows her country's experience with colonialism. Globalization imposes a monoculture, economic and cultural force that destroys communities, cultures, and the ecological integrity of places. This monoculture uses many forms of violence to gain control over the resources that it wants. She explains how nature is bountiful. Nature gives gifts to humanity if we live in partnership with it. And she always talks about indigenous farmers in India and how they've lived for generations in partnership with nature. But that the modern economy, which is based on commodification and privatization, or the enclosure of the commons, and I'll talk more about that, that destroys this harmonious relationship with nature. So commodification, that's where you take natural goods and say that we can make a profit off of this. We can not just survive by what we grow, but we can hoard it. We can condense our ownership and get more and more and find a global market and sell it and make lots of money. That's commodification. So it's the difference between a farmer who's growing a variety of vegetables and grains and helping to feed the village and a farmer who has nothing but acres and acres of soybeans. It's called a commodity crop, right? Because there's a global market for it. So that's commodification. And the privatization of nature's gifts, the enclosure of the commons, traditional societies don't own land. They share it. And in the feudal times in Europe, there were commons. There were places where the peasants could bring their animals to graze.
That's the Woodstock Common.
The Woodstock Common, the Boston Common, right?
Mm-hmm. Most towns had a common.
Yep.
In New England.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's what I mean.
Reflecting what they brought from England, which were common places. But in England and Scotland in the early 18th century, as capitalist thinking was starting to emerge, which is trading on a global market, concentrating production, making profit for those who owned the resources, they started looking at these common lands and said, well, this is inefficient. We're letting these peasants make their livelihoods here, but we can make a lot more money. We can use it much more efficiently. So there were actually laws that enclosed the commons, that privatized the land and said, nope, you can't bring your animals there to graze anymore. You're tough luck. You're on your own. This land now belongs to whoever the dominant person was, the lord or whoever. Maybe it always did belong to a lord, but under feudal law, that it had to be shared. Under capitalism, it no longer has to be shared. It's private property. So that's the enclosure of the commons. And Shiva says that it's not just land, that now the enclosure extends to everything in nature, so that the patenting of genes is an enclosure of the commons. The using the atmosphere as a sewer, sending our carbon emissions is a way of some corporations getting private profit at the expense of something that we all should have access to, that we all should share. This is a quote, the enclosure of each common displaces and disenfranchises people, which creates scarcity for the many while generating growth for the few. Displacement becomes disposability. And this is something she emphasizes repeatedly, that once peasants or small farmers are thrown off their land, they become disposable. The system doesn't really have a use for them. So some of them find their way to the cities and find whatever work they can. In India, many of them are committing suicide because they have no place to go. Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's because they don't have, well, I could be wrong, but I just thought it was because of their farming practices or committing suicide.
That's, well, that's part of it, yes.
They can't earn money like they used to.
But that's hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, it's many people who are in that predicament.
Yeah.
So, so she's highly critical of this whole system, which is forcing people off the land and into cities, which is, if you look at the World Bank or all these big development projects, they see this as progress, right? We're taking these peasants and bringing them into the modern world and producing food more efficiently and et cetera, et cetera. She wants to dispel that whole myth. She says that's not how it really works. It's really all about producing profit for corporations and ruining the lives of millions of people.
Could I just interject? Does anybody know more about how India...
Look at statistics and say, oh, look at how the gross national product is rising. Look at the progress we're making. But remember, we always talk about externalized costs. Mm-hmm. And she's documenting that the costs are very, very high.
Mm-hmm. Ron, can we talk for a moment about the suicides? Has this been happening for how long now? I mean, a number of years? I don't know.
I don't know that either. I think it's in the last few decades.
Yeah, I think so too.
Few decades? Really?
The last few.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know
since
the specifics of that. All right, now so then she takes on this notion of the tragedy of the commons, and we've talked about that here. I remember Andy was explaining it at one point. Garrett Hardin was a writer, came up with this essay called The Tragedy of the Commons. And it argues that people are motivated by their self-interest, and so there's nothing that'll stop one particular shepherd from bringing more animals onto the common pasture. Well, gee, I have a great idea. If I bring more animals here, I can sell them. I'll make more money. I want to do that. Well, maybe it's okay if one person does that, or maybe two, but if everyone gets that idea, you overgraze the commons, you destroy it, and then they're all out of luck. That's the tragedy of the commons. And capitalist thinkers have taken hold of that and said, see, that's why we need a free market. The marketplace assigns prices and costs, and it's efficient, and you don't have the tragedy of the commons. Well, a few years ago, an economist named Eleanor Ostrom, who's not well known, but she won the Nobel Prize, challenged this whole idea and said, that's not how a commons works. A commons is a self-regulating agreement among the people who use it, and it doesn't allow individuals to come in and say, I'm going to make a bigger profit off this. That's just not part of the mindset of a commons. Hardin was wrong, and capitalism is wrong in throwing that out. And so Vandana Shiva picks up on that critique. She says, village-based economies do not rely on competition and self-interest. They are built on the sharing of resources, and they support everyone in the community. That's their culture. That's what they believe. So they would not tolerate the kind of competitive self-interest that Hardin assumes. A commons embodies social relations based on interdependence and cooperation. Greed, domination, exclusion are not essential human qualities. Functioning commons demonstrate that people can govern themselves, that democratic self-organization and self-governance work, and that people can cooperate, share, and jointly make democratic decisions for the common good. This is another way of saying biology is not destiny. We're not inherently greedy. And for capitalist, industrialist ideology to say, nope, we are inherently greedy, therefore we need a system that is built on that, that's not correct. We're not inherently greedy. It's the system that produces it. Now, this is where I'll talk a little bit about anarchism. It's not in my notes, but it came to me kind of spontaneously the last time I went through this. So there's a theorist named Murray Bookchin, who lived in Vermont. He started the Institute of Social Ecology, which is still going on. And it's an anarchist critique of capitalism, which sounds very much like what Vandana Shiva is saying here. It talks about how small communities exhibit self-governance, that there can be democratic governance when that's the values of your culture. And that's what anarchists are really talking about, is governance by the people who participate in a community, that you do not need a hierarchical, authoritarian way of making decisions. There's not much more to say about that. I'm just trying to point out that even though I wouldn't call Vandana Shiva an anarchist, what she is saying reflects this style of thinking that anarchism has elaborated into quite a sophisticated philosophy, which questions the need for massive structures of governance, right? So think back to Joseph Tainter and the collapse of complex societies, right? The reason we're in such trouble is that civilization has become so top-heavy, so many layers of bureaucracy and authority, so much expertise, and anarchism says, let's cut through that, let's get rid of that. That's why Jerick Jensen and John Zerzan, see, I got to say his name again, Zerzan. That's why they're called anarcho-primitivists, because it's cutting through that structure of authority.
Also, you could add specialists.
Specialists, right. Specialization, expertise.
Just to add a little bit on the tragedy of the commons, one of the criticisms of Hardin, which predated hers, but other people made it too, was that, in fact,
the centralized nations, the ones who are at the forefront of the economy and of globalization, we're living way beyond our carrying capacity, right? So carrying capacity is what the earth can provide in resources and how well it can process the waste products, so like carbon emissions, right? But we've exceeded that capacity. We're taking more than can be replenished and filling the water and the air with toxic stuff. So one way to avoid that, Shiva says, is that the system is always looking to expand. It always looks for new resources, new lands to conquer. That's what colonialism and imperialism really are. That's what globalization is.
We like to call it a nice soft word now. It's called growth.
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 Yes. Well, we'll get to that in a paragraph or two. We'll get to growth. So that the industrialized system now just claims the resources wherever it finds them, no matter what nation they're in or what people are living there, they just appropriate it and find ways, violent or not, to take what they need. That's how we live beyond our carrying capacity. She says that poverty and even population growth in the third world are the result of what she calls resource alienation and the destruction of livelihoods. So it's when this economy invades traditional cultures and the ways that they've lived on the land and upsets that, that's where the poverty really comes in. Now, you wouldn't say that traditional ways of living are wealthy in terms that we would understand, but they were sustainable. People were reasonably content and healthy and nourished for centuries. And then development comes in, globalization comes in, and suddenly some people are cashing in on that while many people are impoverished. And there was an anthropologist named Helena Norberg Hodge who documented how this happened. She was in northern India in the Himalayas, a region called Ladakh, and documented how the indigenous agriculture, the small village life, was doing quite well for centuries. And as soon as they were exposed to development projects, roads and telecommunications and things like that, everything that comes with that just ruined their culture. So the individualism and the competition and the greed, it all came in that. So she came out with a book called Learning from Ladakh, and she started an organization called Local Futures. Maybe you've seen the film that they did called The Economics of Happiness, mm-hmm. which addresses all of this. So Shiva criticizes what she calls technological fundamentalism, where we think we're the masters of nature, that we are smarter than nature itself. And here's where we get into growth, right? She says we are driven by our abstractions, by the words that we use for our own purposes, or specifically the people in power, the institutions in power have these concepts, these abstractions. So growth is one of them. Capital, even the term rights. If you own land, you have rights to that land. And Shiva says, well, what's the concrete reality behind all these words? Is there such a thing as capital? And what is it? It's a construct. It's a system of belief that permits this kind of imperialism and domination of resources. So we've allowed these abstractions to substitute for life itself. When reality is replaced by abstract constructions created by the dominant powers in society, the manipulation of nature and society for profit and power becomes easy. The real, the concrete, the life-giving is substituted for by artificially constructed currencies and the abstraction of capital. And this is what she calls monoculture of the mind. We don't live in nature anymore. We don't live in an organic living world. We live in this mental monoculture of money and profit and growth and modernization, whatever other terms you can think of. Finish up with her in the last 5 minutes here. She's a severe critic of the Green Revolution. The Green Revolution was the introduction of efficiency, right, of chemical agriculture, industrial agriculture. She says that it has severely depleted the soil and the water. It makes farmers dependent on corporations for their seeds and chemical additives. When all those costs are considered, and when government subsidies to agribusiness are factored in, industrial agriculture is actually much less efficient than indigenous agriculture.
Is that true?
I don't know. I'm not an expert to really evaluate that, but this has been her life's work, uh-huh. And this is what she's asserting. One statistic she gives is that she says industrial agriculture is a thirsty agriculture. 70% of the fresh water on the planet is being used to irrigate chemical farms. that use 10 times more water to produce the same amount of food as ecological farms.
What is it, externalized costs?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is an answer.
Are we talking about India still or not? Are we focusing mostly on India?
India is her basis for saying this, but then she looks at other places and confirms that it takes place in other places.
70% of water?
Of all the fresh water on the planet is being used to irrigate chemical farms.
It's like a gallon of water for every almond.
Well, that's supposedly not. That's supposedly not true, actually.
Just a couple more quotes from Vandana Shiva. She says, corporate globalization leads not just to the death of democracy, but to the democracy of death, in which exclusion, hate, and fear become the political means to mobilize votes and power, which, of course, we're seeing now. Corporate globalization destroys authentic democracy. The real heads of state are global corporations whose interests are put above the interests of citizens, whose rights are put above the rights of humans and other beings, whose profits are made the highest value, higher than life and freedom. And then she concludes, it is essential to dispel the illusion that globalization is natural or inevitable. Globalization is a political project, and it needs a political response. Our political response needs to put human beings in all our diversity at the center of economic thought. The economy needs to serve people, not profits, in other words. It needs to serve communities and nature, preservation of nature, not just maximizing profit for the few at the top. And so that's what her philosophy of earth democracy addresses that. All right.